A lot of the schemes tried and true are still happening. Writing checks for things that are personal in nature, using the credit card for personal things, stealing the cash receipts. We've got all these new things with cryptocurrency, but the schemes are all the same.
Introducing The Protectors, inside criminal minds from around the world. Presented by the IAFCI, leaders in safeguarding consumers from fraud and scams for more than 50 years. And now your hosts, International President Mark Solomon and Chairman of the Board Michael Carroll.
Hello, everybody. This is Mike Carroll, International Chairman of the International Association of Financial Crimes Investigators. I am with Mark Solomon in Oklahoma City. Mark, how are you doing today?
Mike, we are on location, man. This is great. We have our entire production company here, Modified Media. Mike and I are sitting right across from each other. Our guest is here as well. So the conference, Mike, has been awesome. We're at day two. We had our award ceremony and honored so many incredible investigators here on our first day.
Yeah, that was special. Every year when we have the awards ceremony, it's special. Recognize all the men and women, not only IFCI members, but non-IFCI members that do some great work. How about yesterday? We started out with FIMSI, Financial Industry Mail Security Initiative, put on by the Postal Inspection Service. Yay, Postal. I used to be a postal inspector 29 years, and I retired, and I'm back helping them out. I'm a contractor analyst, so kudos to the U.S. Postal Inspection Service. What a great day they had yesterday.
Yeah, those are your people, man, and our people,
peeps.
So that's great.
Hey, Mark, we're in the exhibit area. It's pretty crowded here, huh?
It is. We have close to 700 attendees here for the week. And like I said, we're in Oklahoma City. We got the Oklahoma City Thunder right across the street from us. So we have a great location. Hotel's awesome. The training and network is second to none.
And Mark, I walked around the exhibit area. You know how many pens I got? I got about 48.
Oh my God. Mike, you can't, you're only supposed to take one from the table. Don't be taking pens.
I'll bring them back.
All right. Well, I'm going to introduce our next guest. Him and I, we go back quite a ways. I go back to my early days in law enforcement and a young detective. And I didn't know that much about financial crimes. And he called me up one day and said, I have a great case for you. And not only did he have a great case, he put it all together before I even started my own investigation. So ever since then, we've been friends. And over the years in law enforcement, he would pitch me some great cases. And you know, it's sort of like bringing a present with a bow right on top of it. It's gift wrapped perfectly, and it's just something you go present to a prosecutor. So he is the principal for Forensic Accounting Services, LLC, in Manchester, Connecticut. And he's a specialized CPA. He has written 5 different books on forensic accounting, fraud investigations, you name it. This guy is one of the experts in the country. He's been in the business for 35 years and has owned his own firm for more than 20 years. So without further ado, our friend Steve Pedno. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Hey, Steve, you know, when I was with the Postal Inspection Service, I worked on a more identity theft, mail theft, but the mail fraud unit worked a lot of embezzlement cases, and they worked, you know, political corruption and related to embezzlement. So I just want to start asking you, you know, you find out somebody that's worked for a company for 30 years, and then they end up stealing from the company, embezzling money. What is like a motivational factor for them to do that if they've been with a company for so long?
Yeah, so it's changed over time. So right now, what I think it is, it's mainly entitlement and living beyond their means. That's what we're seeing recurring. We used to see the gambling and the habits, the drinking and the drugs and things, but we haven't seen that in a long time. It's mainly entitlement. They just want the funds, or they're living beyond their means.
When you mean entitlement, you think like they worked there so long, they deserve it?
Yes.
They've done a lot to make the company successful, and they don't think they're getting paid correctly or something.
That, or they just want to do better. The owners are doing better, the entity's doing better, and they're not doing better, or they want more. So the two are kind of hand in hand between entitlement and living beyond their means.
Yeah. And Steve, let me ask you a question too. Do you find that embezzlements happen more with a small business or a larger business, or is there no difference?
Well, I think they occur in both.
Okay.
And when I say business, I would throw in there municipalities, nonprofits.
Sure.
Anywhere where you've got a finance department, a bookkeeping department, an accounting department, it's happening across the board. And so things are changing in that arena. The long-term employees, yes, they're still on the target, but people don't stay in a job 3 to 5 years and they move on. So yeah, we're still interested in the long-term employees, but we're looking at everybody nowadays. I mean, the whole classic model from 20 years ago, the long-term employee,
right,
who never takes a vacation and nobody does their job when they do, that's kind of out the window now, because we look at everybody. And you'll take one person who embezzled from one context, and then when they go get the next job, they're back to work in a finance department or in accounting doing it again.
Yeah.
So it's changed.
Steve, when you do like a forensic audit, I'm just thinking, are these embezzlers, somebody that works for the company, it's not like you review a couple statements and boom, you found out what they were doing. I mean, they're pretty smart. Were they able to like hide the money, or you got to follow the money? Are these pretty smart people that are doing the embezzling?
So that too is changing. A lot of the schemes tried and true are still happening. Writing checks for things that are personal in nature, using the credit card for personal things, stealing the cash receipts. A lot of the methodologies haven't changed. I mean, the automation has occurred, and we've got all these new things with cryptocurrency and Venmo and whatnot, but the schemes are all the same.
Yeah. And Steve, you know, you bring up a point here about evolution of these type of crimes. And so what you're really saying now, I remember back in the days when I was in school, they would tell us that, oh, it was usually somebody that was getting divorced, had an addiction problem. But I think the message you're trying to tell people that own business, it could be anyone, right? It could be a long-term employee. It could be a short-term employee. So there's not one definition of what an embezzler looks like, I guess.
Sadly, that's true. I mean, we've seen volunteers and nonprofits that have embezzled. We've seen board members and employees alike. So everybody's on the radar now when there's a problem. One of the first things we do, though, when we get a new case is we ask all about the people who work there, because we're banking on the fact that somebody started the job or the position not as a thief,
right,
and something changed in their life. They went through a divorce, kids went to college, they've been traveling more. Something caused them to steal, because historically I've only had six career criminals where they've stolen from everybody they've ever worked for.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're looking for.
Hey, Steve, let me ask you, you mentioned before one of the reasons somebody might embezzle from a company is you talk about gambling. Do you see an increase in that? Because the only reason I'm asking now, like in Illinois, we got gambling machines every corner. I mean, I went to the bathroom one time, flushed the toilet, and I lost $20. I'm just saying.
Oh, no.
But now you got like sports online gambling, like DraftKings and everything. Do you see kind of an increase related to having gambling issues? Is that a problem?
So in Connecticut, we didn't always have casinos. We've only had casinos like 21 years.
We got about 8 in Illinois, all around the Chicago area.
We thought we would see an increase in embezzlement because we had casinos. We haven't seen it. The context where the gambling comes up a lot is when the forensic accounting is used in a divorce arena. All right, we don't just do financial crimes. Forensic accounting can be used in a lot of different contexts. So we've dealt with a fair amount of people going through a divorce that was gambling away the funds. But we've had very few gamblers who are also embezzlers.
Okay.
And Steve, let me ask you something too. When the criminal or the embezzler starts or makes that decision to steal money, do you see that it's a smaller amount at first? And is there any change in the frequency as to how often they steal from a business or company?
Yeah, there definitely is a pattern. All right, for the career criminals, no, they're stealing right off the gate. But for most people, they're going to test the internal controls. They're going to test the waters with a small transaction and see if it gets detected or not. And then what happens is over time, it snowballs and gets bigger and bigger and more frequent, and it just gets out of control. And even when you interview them, they don't even appreciate how much they did and for how long they did it. They just can't get their head around it.
Yeah.
It can't be that much, but it is.
It
just gets away from them. It has a life of its own.
Hey, Steve, when you review an investigation, put it all together, maybe for law enforcement, do you have an opportunity to interview the suspect too, or is that mainly law enforcement that do that?
Oh, no. We want to do the interviews.
Yeah, I would think.
We strategically save some. So every case is a little different. Just to give you a little context, I've probably done north of 500 embezzlement cases in my career.
Oh, wow.
All right. And I always want to interview the suspect.
You would know most of the facts on the case.
Right. But if it's going to go to law enforcement, and I'd say only 1 in 7 ever gets referred to law enforcement, if it's going to get referred, then I might save that bite of the apple for them, because once I talk to them, they're probably going to get a lawyer. So it's strategic. But I'd say 6 out of 7, if not 7 out of 7, yeah, we're always looking for that interview. And they're nice, long interviews, developing rapport, and all the things that you'd think about, like law enforcement's trained, we do the same thing. And they tell us a lot about the case.
Yeah.
A lot of times they come clean. They wanted to tell somebody about it. And then we go forward.
Yeah. Steve, what are some of the red flags that you see, the commonalities? And I'm thinking about business owners or people working for a government or, like you said, a nonprofit. What are some of the red flags that if you're not the embezzler, that you might see and sort of start getting concerned that maybe something bad's going on?
So I'll start with the non-accounting stuff first.
Okay.
You'll know there's a theft before you find it because you'll see it in the lifestyle change. They're traveling more. They're driving different things. They're buying assets. They're dressing differently. You're listening to the stories. What are they doing on weekends? But nobody ever puts it together. Like, I wonder how this is all being funded. So one of the flags to look for is the lifestyle of the people who are entrusted with the funds.
Interesting.
All right. When we go to the internal control piece of it, then we're talking about, you know, who does the job and does anyone else know how to do that job and does anyone else ever do that job? Because if no one else ever does it, then how would a problem ever get discovered? And we've had many cases in Connecticut that were discovered because their appendix burst or they took a trip or they did something. Our most recent case, her ankle broke. So that case was brought to us yesterday.
So that means somebody else uncovered it while they were not there or incapacitated.
They absolutely did.
Wow.
And the flaw in the internal controls that's recommended by auditors is every person should be required to take a vacation. That's true. The flaw is someone else should do their job while they're on vacation because that's when it gets found.
Right.
If you've got the payroll person that always plans their vacation around payroll cycles and then it all waits till they get back, you're never going to find an embezzlement in payroll because they've controlled the entire environment.
Yeah, Steve, that's what I was going to ask you. Why isn't a business owner finding out about it sooner than later? And you mentioned, you know, because they go on vacation, nobody takes their spot to see what they're doing. But is there any other factors that a business owner wouldn't catch this earlier than they do?
So what's happening is business owners are busy running the business. So they hire people and they trust people and they trust the internal controls and they're busy doing other things. They're busy in sales. They're busy developing additional resources, whatever it is. So accounting's kind of always set aside. Ownership level doesn't really like to get involved in the accounting, looking at the bank statements, reviewing the payroll registers, but that's where it's going to get found is if you're an embezzler, you're banking on somebody not doing that detailed review of anything. If you're not independently looking at the check images that cleared the bank, you will never know that I'm writing checks to myself.
How would you know?
And Steve, I want to know too, when the business owner or the company, organization, nonprofit, whatever it is, when they first find out who the actual embezzler is, how shocked are they and why?
I think they're very shocked, all right? And because it's such a violation of trust. It couldn't be that person, all right? If you're brand new to an accounting department or a company, everybody's watching what you do, everybody's watching you. So you've got to get comfortable with everybody. You've got to know the internal controls. And then over time, you're just part of the family. You're part of that department.
Yeah.
And then it's a complete violation of trust. I mean, the emotional toll that's taken is not just on the victim organization. The coworkers are equally emotionally affected by it. It's a train wreck.
Yeah.
Steve, what about somebody that a business owner identifies as stealing funds and they just fire that person? They don't seek prosecution. The only thing with that, I think, is that they could go somewhere else and do the same thing. If they were charged with a crime, that would be on their record. But sometimes you see where owners just fire the person and not do any follow-up.
So I'll tell you, it's a pretty well-known statistic that 1 in 7 get referred to law enforcement. So what happens to the other 6?
Right.
All right. A lot of things. All right. There may be other things going on in that organization that are a greater risk of exposure than the embezzlement. All right.
That's true.
Perhaps they're not reporting all their income. Perhaps they're not paying their payroll all through payroll. There's a lot of different factors. So our job is to find out all the different issues, not just the theft or embezzlement, and then work with the attorneys to strategize. And the reason that we're able to put a package together is because we're involved in this long before law enforcement's involved. And usually in our cases, if law enforcement's involved, it's because we made the referral with permission of the victim and the attorney, and we already have it all put together. We have everything we need.
Yeah. You know, for our listeners out there, if you own a business or, you know, Mike and I could tell you, being in law enforcement and for many years, we encourage you to report it to law enforcement, because we don't want to see this other person just be fired and wind up another job and hurt somebody else or hurt somebody else's company. So
right.
There's a lot of factors in it. There's negative press or stuff like that if you're a company or a nonprofit or anything like that. So we understand that. And sometimes there may be a fair amount of evidence, but maybe, you know, it may not come to a level of probable cause or beyond a reasonable doubt. Whereas on a civil right, it would be preponderance of the evidence, right?
Correct. And all of that's discussed as part of strategy.
Yeah.
We just had a case that got resolved, and it's clear as day he did what he did. But there's not going to be beyond a reasonable doubt. There's no way to really come up with a number that could be taken to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt. All right. So to say there wasn't any probable cause, that's not true. There's just not sufficient probable cause to secure a conviction. Right.
Yeah. And Steve, I want to ask you one other thing too. A lot of people may not understand the difference between an accountant and a forensic accountant. You know, what is the difference? What's the importance if, you know, there is an embezzlement going on to retain a forensic accountant to do that work? And also, you know, if it goes to law enforcement, I'm sure chain of command is a very serious issue that needs to be considered.
So I'll approach the forensic accounting aspect from two components, all right? So traditional accounting, you know, is the financial statement audits, the tax returns, your traditional things you'd expect a CPA to do, help you with your bookkeeping system, do the year-end work. If you need a financial statement, maybe you need projections or some kind of planning. When forensics gets involved, it's specialized. I mean, this isn't a field that you could just dabble in and do one or two cases a year and be really competent at it. You have to understand the process, all right? The civil process, the criminal process. We have a third leg, which is the insurance process, right? We want to recover the funds. How does that work? So when it comes to the law enforcement piece, which is, you know, what we're here to talk about, you know, financial investigations, you have to understand rules of evidence. You have to understand, and accountants, I don't think, have that training that when they get a call from their client, they, you know, everybody wants to be that forensic accountant and help their client out on an embezzlement. The problem is they're not thinking evidence. So they go out on a computer and they start looking into the QuickBooks on the company, and they forever change evidence as soon as they did that. Mm. And they're flipping through the files, and then maybe they bring them back to the office and they don't secure them, and there's no documentation where they collected them, how they collected them. They didn't take any pictures of where they found them, what the office looked like. So why our package is the way that Mark described when he introduced me is because, you know, I started in law enforcement when I was 14 years old, and I was destined to be a federal agent. But I've been through a lot of that training geared up to be in law enforcement. So I then just took a role in public accounting, and then I kind of morphed into doing the embezzlement starting in 1990. And so I'm wired for it. And anybody who's going to call themselves a forensic accountant and put together an embezzlement case, that's the standard I expect. And when I'm on the other side of a case where they have a forensic accountant to put together a poor case, I'm all over it. Because when they get hired, if they don't know what they're doing, I get the second call, but I can't fix it. All right, they've already ruined the computer evidence. They've already ruined all the things that I need chain of custody for.
Right.
You know, now I can create reasonable doubt, right? Was the system changed by you or was it changed by the suspect? I don't know. So, yeah, the specialization, you really have to know what you're doing in this field. And credibility, it's taken me 35 years to get the reputation where attorneys will trust me on cases and bring me into cases. And then law enforcement also, you know, building that network where I get calls at times from law enforcement asking for advice. Like, we're looking at this. What do you think? You know, it's taken a long time to build that reputation.
Yeah. That's why you're here presenting tomorrow in our general session, is there was such a need for that. And law enforcement was asking. I said, I got the perfect guy. I'm getting Steve down to Oklahoma City. So we really appreciate you being here. And Steve, two things. One, if there is a company out there, a business, nonprofit, that suspects that there's some embezzlement going on or fraud going on, how can they find a reputable forensic accountant? Where do you look? Where do you go to? And then if they're interested in speaking to you or retaining your company, how can they get a hold of you?
Sure. So we get a lot of calls, obviously writing 5 books, and I've spoken over 500 times somewhere in the country. I get found on Google a lot, Google search. So I get calls from all over the country. It doesn't matter who's calling. At the end of the day, the only way we're going to get engaged 100% is through an attorney. And that's because we want the attorney-client privilege right from day one, all right? There's no privilege between an accountant and a client. I don't know what they're going to say. I have a lot of questions to ask the victim beyond the embezzlement, like about their tax returns, about other practices they have. I want to know all the ghosts that the suspect are going to put on the table when we confront them ahead of time. But I can't leave that wide open for discovery, so I need to be retained by counsel for the attorney-client privilege. So if somebody thought they had a problem, I'm 100% when I get these calls, my first response is, who do you use for an attorney for your town, your organization, your business? They need to get on board, and then they'll retain us, and we'll set up a meeting to talk about what's going on.
And how if people are interested in reaching out, maybe they have a question or maybe they already have an attorney, how can they contact you if they're interested in speaking with you?
Yeah, so I'm easily found on Google. Just search my name. I'm right there in Manchester, Connecticut. Right. I talk to people all over the country. I generally don't work outside of Connecticut. It doesn't make sense economically to fly me out to do a case in like Washington State. I got colleagues in Washington State that can do it. So I talk to everybody.
Mark, we could put that on the show notes as contact information. Anything you want us to put on the show notes,
we'll
put
on there. Yeah. And we'll put your books out there as well that you've written, because you are one of the four, you know, leading experts really in the country when it comes to forensic accounting and fraud investigation. So we're very honored to have you on the podcast today. One last group I want to bring up to you, and they actually spoke at our board of directors meeting before the conference, is Justice for Victims Project. And Dr. Rice, I know who you know, and
yes,
also Dr. Goldstein. They have an incredible program where they're linking current students, either undergraduate or graduate students, that are studying forensic accounting and other, you know, related criminal justice programs. And they're actually linking them up with law enforcement, prosecutor's office, banking institutions. And they're interning, right, and gaining experience and working real-life cases. Can you tell us more about that project?
I can. I know a lot about it. So I believe it started out in Gonzaga.
Yes. Yep.
It's Spokane, Washington. And I've been out there several times. I met the people who started it, and I actually sat through it where they had finished up a case or two, and they brought in the prosecutor's office, and they presented their findings to the prosecutor. I sat through the whole thing, and I thought, this is brilliant. I mean, you got students who want to basically do the fraud investigation and the forensic accounting while they're learning it,
right,
which, by the way, I teach this at the University of Connecticut, and that's how my class is built. So you're learning it and working on a fraud case simultaneously for 12 weeks. So I know that Dr. Rice has it in at least one other location, but I think there's also a university in Connecticut that's doing it as well.
Central Connecticut State.
Yeah, and I'll be guest lecturing out there in September for their fraud group as well.
Awesome. Yep. Well, that's great work. If there's people that are interested, we'll also put the Justice for Victims Project link on the show notes as well. Because like I said, this is a great opportunity for somebody that wants to go in that field and actually work a real case and assist law enforcement or a prosecutor. It's awesome.
Hey, Mark, it seems like you know a lot of people that write books. You got Steve.
I know.
And then who is the detective I should know? We just had him on.
Oh, Tony Fischella. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
My old partner.
When are you going to write a book?
I'm working.
Right.
The question I have to ask Steve is, Steve, you've written 5 books, you're a teacher, you're a subject matter expert. When do you sleep?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I'm scaling back. I mean, the other job is, you know, I've been working on an ambulance for 30 years.
Oh, my God, on top of that. Wow,
so
saving lives.
I'm
all
starting
right
to scale back a little bit. No, I don't sleep. That's the answer.
Well, Steve, I kind of wrote a book, too. It's called Cracking Cards. It's over at the IFCI booth over there, about the debit card scam that's going on. I help participate with that. It's about 87 pages, but it's a good look for helping law enforcement to work check cases.
That's excellent.
Check fraud cases. But I don't think I'll ever get to 5, but all right.
All right, folks. Well, listen, Steve, we appreciate you here. Your job's not done. You got a general session tomorrow.
Yep.
You're going to teach over 600-700 investigators.
Mark,
here.
Standing room only.
I know. It's great. So, Steve, thank you for coming on and coming out here to share your knowledge with our members, and we wish you the best, and hopefully you get a little more sleep, man. You got to slow it down a little bit.
Hey, Mark, can you reach in my bag in one of my koozies?
A koozie.
Podcast koozies.
All right, I'm going for it right now.
All right.
We'll get him a koozie.
Thank you so much for having me out here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, Mike, for our listeners, we're here live at our conference in Oklahoma City, our international IFCI conference, and it has been phenomenal, and just like our guest was here today, Steve Pedno.
Yep, let's wrap it up. The cookies are here.
Oh, gee, you're always thinking about eating, Mike. You can't take the whole tray and bring it over to your table, all right? So, Mike, if people want to listen to the podcast or subscribe to us, how do they do it?
I like to go to Spotify. That's where I go to listen to podcasts or
I'm
sign
an
up.
Apple guy.
You're an Apple guy?
Yeah.
But, hey, we want you on as a listener. We're the protectors, right? Join us. Mark, can we talk about our presentation earlier from Aaron West? And that was her thing. We need everybody to get involved. We need more protectors out there to protect people from being victims of scams and frauds and embezzlements.
Yeah, it's not just our subject matter experts or UI or modified media. It's you guys listening to us. You could spread the word to other people so they do not become victims.
And she was just talking about, get involved with your church or community groups and get out there and speak. You know, let them know about all these scams and frauds that are out there. You might save a life.
Knowledge.
Or people losing all their money, their life.
Knowledge is power, you know. Like I said, the more you know, the less likely you can become a victim or at least respond quicker and stop it from continuing. So, Mike, I'm going to tell our audience, if there's anybody out there who wants to share a story, maybe they're a victim of a crime or almost a victim, maybe they're a subject matter expert in the public or private sector, shoot us an email. We'd love to talk to you and see if we get you on the podcast. So our email is protectorspodcast@iafci.org.
Yep.
Well, Mike, listen, I think it's time for us to sign off. You know, we're all at the same place, so we can't go with what state we're in. So,
gotta get ready for the Cowboy Museum tonight.
We're going to Cowboys. Yeehaw, I got my cowboy boots and my cowboy hat, and I'm ready.
All right.
All right, folks. Well, listen, I'm Mark Solomon, International President.
This is Mike Carroll, International Chairman, signing off from Oklahoma City.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast. Remember, as you join the fight to protect our citizens, you're not alone. With more than 6,500 members from around the world, the men and women of the IAFCI are standing together with you. To learn more or to join the IAFCI, please visit our website at www.iafci.org. The Protectors Podcast is produced by Modified Media and is available for free wherever you listen to podcasts. The hosts and guests' opinions are their own and do not reflect those of management, employers, or sponsors. Listeners are encouraged to contact law enforcement if they suspect being a victim of a crime.